Welcome, everybody. I'm doing a little experiment today, which is I came with no notes whatsoever. Which is to say, at one level, I'm completely unprepared. Just saying that right up front.
That's your excuse?
Exactly. Well, thank you. Thank you for that, John. We'll find out. We built this as a series of conversations, and I realized last week I did almost all the talking. So I felt a little bit bad about that. Not bad enough to stop, but honestly, we wanted to have some conversation this summer about this cluster of issues about grace and love and community. And there's been a lot going on in the world. Unless you've been on another planet or never read the papers or look at the news, you know that there's been a lot going on. So I thought, really, seriously, we would just talk today. The theme, sort of broadly speaking, reaching in, reaching out, that there is this kind of notion, which I think is just silly, that Christian faith is either about spiritual formation, getting really close to God, developing deep prayer life, and so forth, it's about personal devotion, or it's about caring for the world and trying to take care of people in need and social justice and poverty and that sort of stuff. It's kind of a silly notion that it's about one or the other. And I think if you take the Bible at all seriously, you can't help but notice that it's actually about both, right? The further in that you reach, the further out that you reach. Brian Bach and I, who many of you know, was senior pastor of Christchurch while we opened up the hill, came to Christchurch in September of 1980. I came in December of 1980. So I worked with Brian for 2.5 years. And he was a math major. Some of you have heard me say this. Math major doesn't give you a whole lot of sermon illustrations. which Brian realized a little late, actually. But he had one that was really good. He had more than one, but the one that I remember. And that is of the ellipse. You know what an ellipse is? There's one in Washington, they call it the ellipse. But an ellipse is a geometric form defined as having two foci, two focal points. And the cool thing about an ellipse is that the sum of the distances from the two focal points to any point on the line is always the same. So if you like, so in other words, these are the two points, draw the ellipse like this. If you add the distance from this point to that point, here to here, and here to here, the distance is exactly the same no matter where you are on the ellipse. And Kepler, for example, figured out that that's how the planets work, that they circle around the sun in an elliptical orbit. Finally figured out that that was the pattern. So, how is that relevant? Well, Brian said, and I think it was a great thing, that the two foci, two focal points on the ellipse of the Christian life, are in reach and out reach. That when you reach in, you go closer to God, you go deeper, you understand the heart, the mind, and the will of God. When you reach out, you do God's will, love God, love your neighbor as yourself, and that the whole ellipse of the Christian life is defined by reaching in and reaching out, and that's what forms the shape of the Christian life. So I thought that was pretty cool. I'm not sure I would have majored in math just to come up with that, but it was nice to be here from somebody who did. So, again, I really don't have a whole lot more than that, but we're going to begin with prayer in a minute, and we're going to talk about your experience of reaching in and reaching out, and let's talk about what's going on in the world and how we deal with it. Because some people find the news just to be sort of overwhelming. You know, there's so much stuff going on. It can feel sort of crushing. But it seems to me that Christians ought never to be crushed. And so how it works, that we can actually pay attention to the world, we can do the outreach portion of the ellipse without being crushed, is part of our conversation. So let me close this, but it's noisy upstairs. Gracious God, we gather before you as your people. We thank you for the opportunity to be part of the church. You made us, you are yours, and call us together to be a community of faith. And sometimes this world around us, and even the world within us, can be so full of challenges, so overwhelming that it's hard to bear. But we would be faithful. We would live as you would have us live. So we just ask that your Spirit move among us in this hour. Stir us, help us to learn from you and from one another. Give us a vision of how you would have us live. And then fill our spirits with your Spirit, we have all the love, strength, courage, and joy that we need to live for you. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Alright. Well, I wasn't kidding. That's really all I got.
We're going to be early to
church. So we have a couple options. You know, there are books to buy upstairs, there's stuff to talk about, there's coffee and donuts, or you can go hang out or go to Dunkin' Donuts. Well, I suspect we'll come up with something because people here are usually pretty good at finding stuff. Well, you know, a lot happened, of course. You know, we're all saddened about the events in Charleston, which is, of course, inherently terrible, but in some ways, all the more terrible because it's not the first time. Maybe the first time somebody walked in and shot up a prayer. But it's not the first time. This sort of stuff happens all the time, right? And there are all kinds of other events in the news. Pope, whom the world calls the Holy Father, came out with an encyclical basic point of which is, you know what? We're stewards of creation and we ought to pay attention to that. Well, not surprisingly, all these things immediately send people to their respective poles, right? So some white guy shoots up a group full of black folks. And for people whose legacy of this country is slavery and segregation, it's there we go again, you know? And yet, the response, you read in the paper about some of those people offering forgiveness for this young guy is extraordinary. But it comes piled onto, what, months and months and months, and years and years and years, and decades and centuries, really, of racial crime. And the environment, you know? I mean, you would think that taking care of the earth would be sort of self-evident. But immediately, the Pope comes out with an encyclical before he even came out. And, you know, one gang of people says, see there, the Holy Father says we've got to care about the planet. Another gang of people say, oh, it's just a bunch of fill in the blank, you know, making up stuff. So we don't have to pay any attention to all of that. I don't know about you all, but I sort of long for a community in which people don't just automatically go to their polls. Some black kid gets shot by a white cop, black kid was up to something bad, or the cop must have been evil. Take a poll. Pope says you ought to care about the planet. Well, that's just a bunch of big government-loving liberals who want to control your life. Or let's all go do stuff that's sort of unrealistic as if we didn't really need renewable energy or fossil fuels for the time being. People sort of race to the polls. Not the voting polls, but the polarized polls. I long for a community in which people don't do that. They actually talk about stuff. And they try to find some sense that serves God, loves God, and takes care of people somewhere in the middle. And my hope, and often I have reasons to hope, my hope is that Westminster is and will continue to become that sort of place. Because running to the polls and having a food fight whenever some big thing happens isn't helping us very well. So I was going to say that. You can disagree if you want to. But now I'm going to stop, and people can say stuff. Flo, I think you had a comment.
I was just going to bring up that I saw where John Stewart, he was talking about usually as a comedy, and he said, we sounded just like, ooh, I have nothing today because I'm sad about this shooting. So you started off saying, nothing today, but you will do. That and the whole thing.
I'm going to repeat just so that people can hear Flo saying that I remind her of John Stewart, which I don't get a lot, actually. And though I would have expected that was because he said some brilliant and witty thing, really it was sort of on the opposite. It was because after the shooting, right, he just said, I don't have anything to say. This is just awful. So thanks for the comparison. Yeah, please.
I'm a great fan of Malcolm Gladwell. And his original book is called The Tipping Point. And I don't think we preach the tipping point, but I was impressed with multitudes of the people in Charleston, the church members, and the people in general, and because it's such a contrast between that and what has happened in some of these other cities. And it seems to me that maybe this is a small beginning to how to show, by showing forgiveness and not, because it could have been terrible down there too, it could have been people in the streets again, but I don't think we'll see that.
Janice is saying, again, just repeat so you can hear, Janice is saying that it's been striking the response of the people in the church in Charleston. What you might expect to have led to, you know, more violence in the streets or something, in fact, has been this extraordinary sort of outpouring of grace. Remember some years ago when the Amish community out in eastern Pennsylvania had something similar happen? Somebody came and killed a bunch of people. And the Amish did something sort of similar. And, you know, there's common denominator in there, isn't there? I mean, the Amish are people who take their devotion to God very seriously. They do it in ways that we wouldn't quite do. But it's central to their lives. This is a prayer meeting in a church that got shot up. And those people gathered there to seek to know and do the will of God. I would love to believe it's not a coincidence that when church folk or a Christian community suffers terrible violence, of course there's pain, there's even anger, there's all of that. But what people struggle to achieve is grace and forgiveness. And I'd like to think that's not coincidental, and that that's what churches ought to be.
It seems like that calm, loving response of being able to try put this in the middle rather than at the poles. And it's sort of like, you can't hide from it. And people would like to hide from it, you can't. And because there wasn't shot in the street, and because there wasn't all this anger, it's different. It's powerful.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That Dan suggested maybe, you know, characterizing what people often do is sort of run to the poles. The fact that this is a non-polar response and that it comes out of the church suggests that there is a better way, and maybe this can be a model for those who want to continue.
And that comes out of the South.
And comes out of the South. Yeah, John?
Yeah, I want to say something about the encyclical. What that then about is it's over 80 pages. I'm on page 57. But that's more than say take care of the man. What it does is show that all the issues are interrelated, like they're elliptical.
Yeah.
Taking care of the poor is not unrelated with having a strong economy.
Yeah.
They're taking care of the planet.
Yeah.
But he does a really good job, he's done his homework of actually very convincingly showing that all these issues are interrelated. And I hope everybody that takes the time to read it and see if you can come away by agreeing with that.
Yeah, again, to repeat, John is saying that, of course, I was giving sort of the Twitter version of the encyclical, but John's pointing out that, of course, it's not just take care of the planet. It's that all this stuff, poverty and extremes of wealth and poverty and the stewardship of the planet and the environment, all those things are related. And the Pope says that very thoughtfully. I downloaded the encyclical last week. I haven't started to read it yet, but I plan to do that, absolutely. And by the way, to that point, I said I don't mean notes. I don't mean notes. I don't make stuff up. We had, what was it, a couple years ago, the Malawi folks were here, and it doesn't matter, a couple years ago. So we're talking to the pastor of the Church of Malawi, Zahn. So how's it going? Well, we're having trouble with our men's ministry. Why are we having trouble with men's ministry? Well, because all the men are depressed. Why are the men depressed? Because they don't make work. Why don't they make work? Well, because, you know, Malawi is strongly agricultural economy, rural tea, and some other stuff. And the men can't find any work. Why can't they find any work? Well, because we've had a drought for all these years. And what do you make of that? And so, well, because the climate is changing, of course. We have not seen this kind of drought. And so here we are talking to pastor and whoever it was, clerk of session or somebody, from our sister church in Zomba, Malawi. And we're talking about churchy stuff, men's ministry. And in about 2 minutes, the conversation went from not going so well with the men, because they're unemployed, because there's a drought, and there's no agricultural work, because the climate changes, precisely to your point. And so the Malawian folks are always kind of struggling on the edge of hunger. Guys are unemployed. It's always bad when young men are unemployed, or any significant percentage unemployed. And so in 2 minutes, we got from a conversation about men's ministry to climate change.
That
it's all connected.
Also part of the violence.
And violence. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, please.
I'm back to Charleston. I don't have any surprise that we had that reaction from the people in that church from the South, from Charleston, South Carolina, and the South is a good place. But by and large, race relations in the South, I think, are much healthier than they are in the United States. For example, St. Louis, not so good. But mostly in the South, they're good. And, you know, if you haven't been there and if you haven't lived there, you might still be reading the stereotypes that are decades old. But it's a new South.
Well, okay, so Sarah's saying, actually, you know, Northerners sometimes talk as if it's remarkable that there's, you know, interracial harmony in portions of the South, that there should be better relations because we think of the South in terms of slavery and segregation. But in fact, there are certainly many places where there is a lot of work on that. And on the other hand, the North has certainly not always been exemplary. I grew up in Washington County, and the Ku Klux Klan was still burning crosses in Fayette County, right below where I lived growing up. So, yeah, to your point. That said, however, among the things that got stoked by this latest shooting is the question of the Confederate flag flying over the state capitol in South Carolina, right? And again, I don't have a judgment to make about that, but just to speak to the polarization. For one group of people, that is, of course, a symbol of slavery and segregation and all sorts of awful stuff that wasn't episodic, but systemic for generations. To another group of people, it's, yeah, but my grandfather, my great-grandfather died at Antietam or someplace, and this is not about that, this is about something else. Okay, I mean, you can sort of see both of those points, but it still polarizes because people choose the thing that they want to emphasize, and somehow, it seems to me, we don't always take into consideration the depth of the impact of some of the things that we do on other people. We all do what we do because we can justify it, of course, and we all tend to justify what kind of works for us, but in doing that, I think, we're all tempted to emphasize the things that we think are important and minimize the things that other people think are important and tell ourselves that it ought to be the way we want it to be. And I think I see that across the board. So again, I would like to think that churches would be a center where people just don't routinely run to the opposite poles, but that we become the sort of place where people actually consider how this stuff affects one another and ask, what can we do about it? Others could think.
I'm digressing a little bit, but a lot of us in this room yesterday went to protest with people on the North Side. And I was so impressed. I've been there a couple of times. I was so impressed by all these people, obviously less well off than any of us there. Well, first of all, so appreciative of getting it. Thank you. And I don't know how many times I was told, God bless you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was wonderful to hear.
Yeah,
you're ministering too.
Yeah.
And you'll hear ministering to them.
Yeah. Yeah, Dave was talking about being a protest of people yesterday and people being grateful for the support, but also saying, God bless you. And a blessing is just that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is something that people give to you. Did you have a comment, Chuck?
Yeah. One of the things that impressed me was I've been there a number of times, but there's so many young people. That young people that have that are in need, they're coming through the line as we were passing out food. And they were very, very appreciative as well.
Yeah. Anybody that's not been in here?
I was a runner with the food. We help people with the food cart to take it to their car. And that's probably a 10-minute walk. And they have fascinating children. These are fascinating. And it's always, it's easy to have a conversation about that. And yet, because they're not with us, we tend to think instantly
some of us have read the book of Half Ears, The Faith and Life, we do that in Substitute. And one of the things they talk about is they sort of weave together a bunch of social stuff and brain science, which I enjoy. And they say, you know, people put an fMRI on somebody's head, and they watch what lights up when they think about different things. So if you have somebody think about poverty, let's say, show them a picture of sort of poverty, you know, run-down neighborhood or something, some portion of the brain lights up, it's all about abstract stuff, like math and ellipses and, you know, paying your taxes or something. You have people think about a particular person that they know who might be a poor person, and a whole different part of the brain lights up. Now it's not some abstract phenomenon, it's a person. And that just changes completely. It's kind of the next point. You know, if you're a runner, you actually get to know some people. You go to give food to the poor. Well, the poor is just some abstraction that lights up the part of your mind that talks about math and, you know, your computers. You get to know some people, and suddenly they're human beings, you know? And part of the problem in our society is that we live in these isolated communities. We live in Upper St. Clair, Peters Township, you're a fairly homogeneous community, right? You just don't see folks like that. And so the poor becomes some sort of abstraction that you might have some compassion for, but you might think, well, why don't these lazy people just go find jobs? You sort of deal with it abstractly. You get to know people, and you realize all kinds of stories. Yeah, and that makes a difference.
I'd like to make a pitch for Shim in that regard.
Yeah.
Because Shim did come to the Endowment Committee years ago. They're trying to reach kids in schools because if you were, you know, if there are poor, there are poor people in Upper St. Clair and Dallas, to try to find out who they are because they're more reluctant to go for help. And then at their recent banquet, they had people from Prospect Park, all of whom had come from basically refugee camps. I mean, and they told their stories. And they're wonderful human people. What they have gone through is amazing. And then I mean, there is a lot of help that can be given very close to home.
Again, just repeating so you can hear. Janice is pointing out that Shim actually provides an opportunity not far from us to get to know some folks as people and break through that. So if people do want to help out, we have opportunities to do that here. And by the way, that's one reason why our outreach emphasizes local and national and international issues. Because it's harder for most people to go to a place like Haiti, right? I mean, you've got to spend some money, take a week off of work, stuff involved in that. It's less hard to go, you know, to Bethel Park, possibly Park or something. But what happens is, once you start to think of people as being human beings, not entirely unlike us, who for various reasons don't have the privileges and opportunities we have, then the whole concept of mission becomes less a sort of abstraction out there, whether you're talking about, you know, Arizona or Haiti or Bethel Park, it becomes about real people. So, just to Dennis's point and to underscore it, anybody that doesn't have the opportunity to spend time with other folks, that's a really, really good thing to do. Because you can help them, as Dave says, sometimes you get a blessing from it, and it makes these kind of abstract issues real. Yep.
Just thank you for mentioning Shim, by the way. One of the things that I think that Shim came up with that is really smart to get our board of directors involved is we have a Thanksgiving dinner every year. And it is the board, and it's the families from the refugee center in Prospect Park. And it was always, oh, Shim will bring a turkey and stuffing, and we'll have a Thanksgiving dinner. And they said, no, we want to cook for you, too. So they make their own. Never tried the goat. I'm told it's wonderful. It goes really fast. But they bring sort of their national dishes. One woman spends 3 days making couscous. And when you think of Prospect Park after you've been to that dinner your first year on the board, you think about Prospect Park very differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the kids get up and perform, and it's wonderful.
Again, Carolyn's saying that Shim folk, it's a great way to meet people, but they also kind of bring their own food and want to serve people. You know, I'm English, German, and Scottish, you know? Scott's idea of good food is haggis. Like, really? Seriously? And the English is tripe, you know? Really? You want to go meet people that serve stuff like couscous, you know, and spicy goat and that kind of stuff. Because if you just grew up on haggis and tripe, you really need to kind of extend your world.
Dave? Yesterday, there were an awful lot of young people there from our church handing out food, and some of the adults said they like to bring their children so that they can see the other, half of
And the point being what?
Get an appreciation that there is poverty, real poverty.
Oh, I see. Bring their children from places like the churches so they can see it. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. If you're young and you're in Milwaukee, the new one's several, they serve 530 people. So they saw faces, talked to them, et cetera. What an experience for somebody who's a kid.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Others? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Please.
Sorry. Was there Tony over there? Back to South Carolina. And I haven't done this. Part of it's opportunity, but just I haven't done it. And I'm not good at it. And that is, take a horrible situation, such as what happened there, and use it to speak our faith to other people. Mm-hmm. Because there are people, I haven't personally heard it, but I'm sure, that say, oh, that's what they say because they're church people, but I wonder if they really forgive. Or how can someone possibly forgive that terrible sin? It's an opportunity for Christians to really speak and share faith, evangelize. And I want to learn how to do that better.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I'll just repeat again. It's saying, you know, there's an opportunity here because some people who are sort of skeptical of that kind of radical forgiveness say, oh, come on, that's just church stuff. That's the kind of stuff you expect churchy folk to say, and I forgive you. Just kill my mother, and you kill my son, and churchy folk will just say, I forgive you. Well, first of all, it's kind of a shallow notion to think that any child that lost her mother or any mother that lost her son would just sort of glibly say, I forgive you because they come to church. I mean, anybody that imagines that doesn't understand the depth of loss. But Sandy's point is a really good one, that so here's an opportunity. For those people who think that religion is just, you know, something that weak people need as a crutch or something, and for those people who are truly baffled, like, really, seriously, somebody just killed your mom, killed your son, and because you're part of this church, you're working on forgiveness? If anybody can really understand some of the depth of what that struggle must be like, what a redemptive teaching opportunity to say, well, yeah, when the faith sinks in, when it stops being just up here having some opinions about God, and gets down here, it starts to shape the way you live, yeah, people actually do struggle to forgive the person that killed their son. And that's a moment for us to say, no, this is real, and this can shape the way we live. Thank you for your work. Yes, please, ma'am.
Yeah, I think to go back to the original talk and say about the polarities that we have, and that's one thing. I mean, it's not an either-or. And everything, everywhere I walk, it's either-or. Either you want this or you want that, or that change of rule, is what really wants that. There's polarities all over, instead of using the both and concept. And I think that's the message to somebody who is showing in front of you. You're going to anger and then processing that you can feel compassion, but it's the faith and more.
Yeah, I'm really saying, you know, people go to the either or, to the poles, but often reality is more complicated. It's both and. And again, church can be a place where we lift up both of the end. Let's take a minute and talk about this pole thing. Again, I'm not talking about going to pole, I'm talking about polarization. I think everybody sees that our society is pretty well polarized. What do you think is going on now? I think reasonable people sitting in a room like this can absolutely agree with what Mary Lee said. Yeah, of course it's more complicated. Okay. So we kind of nod and say, well, yeah, of course. But so much of our public discourse is black and white, sometimes literally. But this or that, good guys and bad guys, and, you know, my team and your team, my party versus your party, liberals versus conservatives. people flock to the polls, and our culture these days seems to stoke that. And the people that don't run for Congress anymore often say things like, you know what, it's just too ugly. It used to be that you could get some stuff done. It used to be that you'd have your debate, and one side would emphasize this, and one side would emphasize that, and then you go out and have a beer, and you say, all right, what are we really going to do? And you work something out that kind of works for everybody, and nobody's totally happy, but stuff gets done, and the country goes on, and you kind of kiss and make up at the end. Now, a lot of people say, you know, it's just too ugly. I still ain't part of it. I can't do anything. Why do you think we've gotten to that state?
Because we're all motivated by something that we think that we're separate from everybody else. Right? But the encyclical says, and I think Jesus says, we're all one. Mm-hmm. But what makes us one is not our ideas, our beliefs, it's this love. Mm-hmm. But if we don't have that, then we're all going to be motivated by self-interest. Just I love myself, but I don't love my neighbor. And so my self-interest favors this collection of things, and I'm not interested in someone else's, you know, interest. You know, maybe they're poor and I like to be rich. That's kind of gross. But it really is that.
You hear what John's saying? That our default value is to be motivated by self-interest, right? And so if that's all we have to motivate us, then of course we're going to do what fits us, and so that drives to whatever goal works for us. The encyclical points out that if we are in fact one by virtue of being children of God or called by Christ, then self-interest can't be a decisive factor in how we relate to other people. That default value has to be qualified by love that we find in God and that God commands of us. And if you really believe that, if that again seems from here to here, then you're not just driven by self-interest.
One more thing.
Yeah.
This doesn't work. The encyclical is saying that things are not working. There is violence because there is poverty. And if we want to solve violence by having more laws, that's not going to do it. Laws aren't going to reduce that violence. But I think what it's saying is we have to come together and work on this together and have a common sense that everybody can use it the same. In a way.
I agree with the self-interest thing that John's saying, but I think part of what polarizes people is fear. Fear of a whole lot of things. Fear of what we see happening in our own country, what we see happening in Charleston, fear of what we see happening in the world. Fear that we are so powerless in and of ourselves to change any of these things. And we were talking about the outward, inward. I've often heard fear as being lack of faith. That's where I see the inward going back in to nurture, faith in God and faith in other people in order to be back out and confront the fears as they are.
Yeah, that's really good. Barbara's saying fear is part of what drives people to the polls, because if you feel powerless and threatened, then you feel like, oh, I can't do anything about this by myself. Sort of naturally seek support of other people. You seek some group to be supportive, and so you kind of run to whatever group you identify with. And that fear is, in some ways, the opposite of faith, because what enables people to break out of that is a faith that God will be there with us. We may or may not prevail, but God will be there with us. We don't have to be afraid, because ultimately the one in charge has got it. It's going to be King David. And so faith can be a powerful antidote to fear. It's absolutely true. And I guess I would add that it seems to me, in addition to self-interest, which is clearly important, and I say this once in a while, it seems to me that fear-mongering for fun and profit is a huge industry in our country. It doesn't matter which side you're on. Making people afraid is a great way to get people to watch your show, and therefore to get advertisers. It's a great way to sell books. It's a great way to get invited to make high-class speeches at organizations that want to be scared by the stuff that you want to scare people with. That seems self-evident to me, that there's a lot of money to be made and power and prestige in fear-mongering. And we know from brain science that our brains are wired such that if you think there's a danger, talk about this. Picture, saber-toothed tiger in the savannah, 100,000 years ago. you see a saber-toothed tiger, your first thought isn't, this is a saber-toothed tiger. I'd like to learn more about this. Let me study him. I wonder if he's had lunch yet. No, if you don't do that, you run, right? We are wired, if we are afraid, to get the heck out of there or to stand and fight. So when people do fear-mongering, it triggers that whole amygdala thing of fight or flight, right? And it just, it literally short-circuits the rational process. So people are onto this. They have figured out that if I can just scare people, and then I make them insecure, and then they're looking for something to feel secure, and then I tell them I have the answer, that's a pretty good formula for getting to do what I want, buy my books, you know, watch my show, vote for me. And so it's not coincidental that people feed the polls because there's profit to be made in doing that, right? Yeah, please, sir.
And fearmongers have an excellent use of adjectives. You did not say you saw a hungry saber-toothed tiger. You saw a saber-toothed tiger. But the fearmongers would add that it was a hungry, vicious-looking saber-toothed tiger.
Right.
Quite a different animal.
Right, right. So he's pointing out that fearmongers are also affected with adjectives. I mean, it's true, though, isn't it? I mean, adjectives and nouns, which then serve as shorthand for a bunch of stuff that scares people, right? Heather?
Well, I think that people without a vision then perish, because if you're looking at extremes, you can see that society or groups of people are perishing because of all of this, and without a vision. It seems to me that if one group of people have a vision, they expect everybody else to see the same vision, or one vision will go out of proportion in terms of realistic ability to perform some good, and then a bubble will form, a negative bubble, on another side. What we need to see, then, is a vision that encompasses at a steady pace a growth towards a vision for all, so that we're not looking for the Republican vision or a Democratic vision. We're looking at a vision that unites and that moves at a pace that functions realistically. It's not an idealistic vision of utopia. It is a vision that works locally, nationally, whatever. But it has to work for the inner cities of large populations, as well as a rural south or different aspects. And we can't always do that on a national platform. We need to have a vision that is allowable to work in all situations and that grows incrementally.
Yeah, that's good. Again, the theme here being vision, that in the absence of vision, people perish. That's a biblical quotation. And so I was pointing out that a lot of us who have some sort of vision just sort of expect that other people should have it. And then people burn out and they get disillusioned when, oh, heck, nobody else shares my vision, so I'm tired, I'm going to go home. No, she's pointing out that it has to be kind of a long, slow, incremental progression, and then we have to sort of put that vision out there. Again, something the church is ought to be pretty good at is casting vision. But you have to expect to be in it for the long run, you know, and people, they get burned out, which is why in the plug for this conversation today, he said, you know, James says faith without works is dead, but works without faith are not likely to last. Because if you just think, the world has been waiting for me, I could have had a V8. Just because I've appeared, now they're going to change their ways, and people aren't going to be self-interested anymore, and they're going to love their neighbor, and they're going to take care of the planet, and they're going to eliminate racism because I'm here. Well, that's silly. So works without faith, outreach without image, is unlikely to be sustainable, to your point. So we've got to be a community in which the vision is cast, and you expect sort of incremental change. But I'll tell you my incremental change joke. You all heard this. This is pretty good. Turn off the paper. Had an English, I don't tell this from sermons, but I tell it in groups like this. I had a sort of curmudgeonly old English professor retired from Dickinson College when I was there. I went to visit him one day. Funny guy. But in a sort of old English professor curmudgeonly way. And he was talking about a desperately boring faculty meeting once, where the dean was droning on and on and on about change and the need for change at the college, and everybody's bored and doodling on their tablets and stuff. So the dean is going on and on about the need for incremental change. And one of the professors piped up and said, well, so like, what's the opposite of incremental change? And another curmudgeonly old English professor said, well, I suppose it would be excremental change. So you gotta show people that change is likely to be incremental and it's not going to be excremental. But you gotta be in for the long run. Joan, you had a comment.
I think one of the reasons that we go from here to the polls is it's comfortable there, and we get a lot of support for being in one place or another. And what Heather is suggesting is living in an ambiguous state, and that's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes a lot of work. It takes faith. It takes thinking to reconcile that ambiguity. And it's as you say, it's incremental. And it's hard.
Yeah, Joan's pointing out that it's easier. It's more comfortable to be in a black and white situation. Ambiguity is hard, and there's tension. I got to hold things in conflict. I got to hold the fact that police officers have a really tough, dangerous job, and sometimes they overreact. And at the same time, I got to hold the fact that, yeah, but if you're a young black guy and you expect to get shot by the cops just because you're a young black guy, that's not good. It's just easier to come down on the side of the cops or the young black guy, right? It's easier to come down on the side of the liberals or the conservatives, the tree huggers or the, the denialists people. It's just easy. It's harder to put yourself in tension. Who has anything by not being involved? Okay, Flo, go ahead.
I'm just thinking with all we're saying here and how complicated the world is and the decision-making is so hard for people, and that's why having the support of community organizations is so important, because otherwise people rush to choose something because it's so hard to make a choice and keep up with all the changing information and, just work it out by yourself. You have to have a support community.
Yeah, the need for support to sustain you because this is hard for all the reasons people said. But again, that's part of what church can be, isn't it? Because what we want to get to in the next 15 minutes, among other things, is, so how do you sustain this? Again, faith without works is dead, but works without faith are not likely to last. So how do we sustain it? Carl?
Well, no, we said we so many times this morning. That's collectively, that's appropriate. But it really boils down, in my mind, to me. I have to make the decisions. I really want to be a child of God. But I have to rely on all of you to support me, to help me on my way. That may not be the easiest task you're all going to have. But I appreciate the fact that so many people have an influence on me, but it's my personal decisions that we will try to do. And I personally struggle with it. 24 hours.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Carl was saying, it really comes down to me and my own decision. I need your help, but it's going to be hard. I'm going to be a challenge.
But that's the opportunity.
Exactly, it's the opportunity, but it's also true of all of us. I mean, you just voiced what is true for all of us. We have to decide for ourselves. You all need to help us. We need to help each other. But it's a challenge because we're hard. No, that's good. That's really good. Yeah, please, Jim.
Is it possible to say the polarization is a result of a good thing that's happened, that both sides have a voice now, where 60 years ago, African Americans didn't have a vote, didn't have representation in government. LGBT didn't have someone looking out for their rights. The poor didn't have the war on poverty. And from the other side, you might say that during the time of runaway inflation, government was growing so there was no one really reining in spending. And so, from a conservative point of view, they didn't have the power to maintain the economy. So I think there's a bright side to it that, you know, now people have a way to have someone represent them in government, but the problem is you get very diverse positions. It, you know, doesn't need to be a zero sum, but sometimes that's where it works out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Jim's saying that the polarization, of course, is bad for a lot of reasons, but it might be a symptom of something more fundamental that is good as far as it goes, and that is more voices, more diverse voices, have access to the air and other forms of communication. So if you have only a homogeneous group of people making all the decisions and describing the news and so forth, you get more uniformity, but that's because a lot of people aren't being heard from. So we might expect exactly what we're seeing, that as there are more and more voices with the means to communicate, the internet, cable, media channels, and whatnot, you'd expect to see more diversity and easier polarization. And that's true. That's a really good point. Gwen and I just started watching Mad Men. Did anybody watch that? We never saw it. It's, they just finished, seventh season. We're like on the cutting edge of 7 years ago. So we just kind of tuned into this. And if you've seen it, I mean, it's about an advertising agency in 1960, basically, is where it starts, right? And what's wonderful about it, besides all the avocado, decorations and shag rugs and, you know, beehive hairdos and stuff, flips and stuff. What's wonderful, besides all the sort of evocation of the appearance of 1960, is attitudes that I've just kind of forgotten about. I mean, these guys are all chauvinist jerks. I mean, many of them. I mean, just the women in the secretarial pool, and of course they're all in the secretarial pool, are just subject to all kinds of stupid stuff that guys say that now, you can get seriously smacked down for doing that, and rightly so. But it's just part of it. And they start talking about Jews, you know, and there's this woman that comes on, she's Jewish, and she has a store. So let's talk about Jews. And, you know, black folks, I'm not even sure they've showed up yet, at least in a few episodes of. So my point is, exactly to your point, I'm just getting a massive reminder of what 1960 was like. And in a lot of ways, you know, things were better, but in other ways, exactly to your point, there were whole groups of people that not only did you not hear from publicly, they were just sort of written off as, you know, in stereotypical and dismissive ways, including, by the way, the minority that's 52% of the population, which is women. So, yeah, we're hearing a lot more stuff, but that's partly because a lot more people have voices today.
I think Jim's really onto something. I think the flip side of that is we haven't quite figured out how to process or deal with hearing so many voices. And the technology that we have and the media that we have allows us just to pick and choose the voices that we agree with and listen to them and filter out all the other voices that are out there, and they become the they that we can marginalize.
Yeah, you've probably heard Ted. The problem is now, it's sort of the Google problem. There's so much information out there, so many voices. It's hard to kind of sift through all that in useful ways and easy to then pick out the segment you want to deal with. And interestingly, people were saying this 20 years ago when the internet was sort of just taking off. They said, you know, there's going to be two opposite things going on. One is going to be the democratization of the media. So anybody that can afford a computer can get on the web and news channels proliferate so you get different voices. So it's going to be sort of democratization of the media, but it's also going to mean the atomization and fragmentation of the media. And, therefore, people will be able to choose portions of the media that reinforce what they already believe. I'm pretty sure that happens. I'm pretty sure that people that like Fox News get all their news and opinion from Fox News, and people that like MSNBC get all their news and opinion from MSNBC. And so, paradoxically, at a time when there's, it was sort of like the rhyme of the ancient mariner, you know, water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. There's stuff everywhere, but you can choose to get only the parts that you like. So I run into people all the time who believe some stuff that I think is sort of kooky. And I say, well, how can you possibly think that? And it's because their sources of information are really, really narrow. So yeah, that's the problem. We haven't quite figured out how to deal with that. Please.
Yeah,
Well, when you add to what Jim said, the enormous demographic shifts, you know, that have been going on for the last 20-plus years, and it won't be long before whites are minority.
Yeah, that's
and then these people that say, I want my country back, at 80, they're talking about that. I have a sister who has a house in Texas and a house in Iowa, and she and her husband are just adding to that, I want my country back. And we're going to visit her in the summer, and we're negotiating the terms under which we'll have discussions. I have another sister that feels just like I do. And she said, oh, my God. Without clear rules, it will last about 10 seconds. But she vigorously believes on
that. Yeah, then Dennis saying he has a sister that seriously believes things rather different than he does. It's kind of like setting up a diplomatic meeting. You know? It's like John Kerry trying to get the Iranians to talk to somebody else. You know, you got to send your people ahead to work out the terms of the visit, and it's your own sister. Yeah.
I just read something this morning. It was about Mount Lebanon. And the rules are set for a meeting. There will be no signs, there will be no shouting. They had a bunch of stuff, and I think they didn't have an arm bar there. They're going to come for information,
right.
And they have experts giving it, and they're supposed to sit there and not say it.
Yeah, I live in Mount Lebanon. Talk about the Mount Lebanon deer issue. I live in Mount Lebanon. Five of those deer live in my backyard. So I can tell you passions run high on this issue. Yeah.
The rules, they make rules.
The rules for the conversation is important. Yeah. Whether you're talking about, you know, climate change or the Middle East or what to do about the deer or visiting your sister, you got to set up the rules for the conversation. Which, by the way, I know people, of course, have different opinions on the whole same-sex marriage thing. But honestly, I think, by the grace of God, one of the things that was good here was that we had the good conversation, right? And people come down in different places, and that's okay. But no food fight broke out, and people love each other, and they say, well, I still don't agree with you, and here's why, and that's okay. But we managed to have a conversation. And surely that's what church should be, right? Please, Heather, go.
I think, so getting back to your point about your sister in Texas, she has experiences that you don't have. She has maybe knows people or something, or knows some people who have climbed over the wall or brought sickness or whatever to, or whatever. So oftentimes it's the experiences in life that we have had that determines to a large extent whether you have, yesterday I put up 6 deer repellents. Okay? Yeah.
She lives right behind me, Mel.
Right.
I have the other kid.
And we live in the same house.
He's got 10 and I've got, yeah. So, but I'm really afraid of, you know, getting my grandchildren coming to play and getting sick on the deer ticks and seriously getting sick, you know. So I, that's my experience because I have known people who suffer from arthritis at a very early age because they had a deer tick that was untreated. Now, to get back to the experiences, both of those included, many of our experiences are going to determine our ability to think in terms internally or externally in the world. Also, they're also going to determine to a large extent the mental health of some people who have experienced tragedy or whatever. It seems to me, if as Christians we need to be able to listen to those experiences, but we also need to relate our experiences that have had a shocking impact on our lives and how we have dealt with it in such a way that we can now accept God and faith and determine how
how we're going to continue living with respect for other people and helping, not just respecting them, but doing something for them that they need or want and want. So I think we need to experience it, and of course, I'd like to put a plug in for the Sunday school, because at a very young, early age, I think children need to know God. They need to know who God is, and the power of God, the power of prayer, to see a boo-boo heal, and to know that God is going to take care of you, is a very helpful experience that you can relate to God.
This is really good. I'm going to break in because we only have a couple minutes. So
let me just kind of go on.
We'll talk in the neighborhood. But a couple of really, really important points, and this kind of harks back to what I was saying, is like experiences. You know, people's experiences shape how they live, for better and for worse. So people in church that have horrible experiences that can respond with that graciously, part of the point that Sandy's making, but also people that have the experience of a loving Christian community and support that other people haven't had. Amy Weingarten is talking about the KCC thing coming up in September, if you haven't heard it, here at 11 o'clock. Big thing to kind of lift up church. Well, lots of people have no use for church because they've never experienced good church. Their experience of church was boring, or some priest did a bad thing to some kid, or their church was just full of judgment and condemnation and criticism. A lot of people's experience of church has been a bad experience. So on one hand, we have what Sam's talking about, people have had bad experiences in life, and then God got them through. We need to tell that story. We also need to lift up the experience of good church that a lot of people haven't had. And that's what our Taste and See thing is going to be to us all. Would you hand up before Doug or no?
I just wanted to make a comment briefly about the industry of fear.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are three legs to that. It's fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I don't mean to make a blanket statement. Take any endeavor of mankind, whether it's weather, or the news, or the Word of God, there's some element that sells itself based on FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
FUD. And not a FUD. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt, yeah. All right. And people in the fields of business. All right, we have just like 2 minutes to land the airplane here. So what does sustain us? Let's have short comments if people can. Given all we said about the complexity of dealing with stuff, the emotional impact, all the stuff that we've been talking about, how hard it is. And by the way, we are, that's futureful, we are the privileged portion of the spectrum as the world goes, right? Yeah, there's Bill Gates and Donald Trump and those guys. Yeah, and compared to them, we're all kind of slackers. But compared to the world at large, we're pretty much over here towards one end of the spectrum. So what that means is if there has to be some giving up of some privilege, and I don't know how much that is, it depends on a whole lot of context. It is probably the case that many of us will, in terms of immediate short-term cost-benefit analysis, possibly have higher costs than benefits. I mean, that's pretty clear, I think. So it's not surprising that if we're just motivated by self-interest, we have a lot of incentive not to deal with a lot of this stuff. So part of the question is, and we only have seconds now. Maybe it's a rhetorical question. What will sustain us, given how hard it is, and given that, in terms of immediate, short-term, personal self-interest, the solution to some of these things probably is going to involve more cost than benefit to us in purely kind of material terms. Given that, what will sustain us for the effort? Grace. Couple more words about that? Grace. The grace of God as a model for what grace is, but also the power of the Holy Spirit in enabling us to be gracious. Love. God's love. Again, not just the model. When people talk about Jesus as sort of the model of a good guy that we should all follow, that leaves me completely cold. Because I know Jesus is better than I am, but that doesn't help me, right? Just to know Jesus is a really cool guy and I should be more like Jesus doesn't help me at all. Believing that the grace of God through the power of the Holy Spirit can transform my spirit and make it less self-serving and self-interested and more loving and gracious That helps. Yeah, yeah.
I think if we can learn to identify first as children of God and second as anything else.
Ah, good. Identify as children of God. Marilyn?
I'm going to say love, too, because it eradicates fear.
Yes. Perfect love casts out fear. We read that somewhere. Yeah, this is really good. If fear is one of the major problems, love is an antidote. Right.
The practical side of this is sort of training. Like when we talk about how do you talk to people with the other polarity or the either polarity. For example, what do you say to someone who says, oh, global warming is just made up by, liberals or something? How do you talk to people?
Right.
So
you
don't turn
the,
so we need to be trained in a way.
Yeah.
Come on, listen.
Listening is always good. If everybody's doing the talking, nobody's doing the listening, right?
Right.
This is good. Well, actually, this segues to next week, because next week, sort of conclusion of this segment, about sort of who's in and who's out and how do we become the beloved community, which then, after a break for 4th of July weekend, will segue to conversation on race that we've been planning for a long time. So hear more about that next week, and particularly in light of the stuff that's just happened this last week, it's very timely. So thank you all for being here. You know, for showing up without any preparation, this is okay. Thank you.